This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Last summer, Pope Francis issued a strong critique on the way we manage the environment. In his encyclical, the Pope said the Earth is suffering because of human-accelerated climate change and called for a kind of deep conversion. His message sent reverberations far beyond the Catholic world. It has generated conversations in religious, academic, and political circles here and abroad. The Wake Forest Divinity School is sponsoring a panel to examine the Pope's challenge. The discussion takes place tonight, 7 o'clock, at Wake Forest University Charlotte Center in Charlotte. Joining me now is Miles Silman. He's part of the panel and is a conservation biology professor at Wake Forest University. Welcome, Miles. Good to have you here. Also with me, Elizabeth Gandolfo. She's on the panel, an assistant professor of Catholic and Latin American Studies at Wake Forest University School of Divinity. Welcome to you, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Tell us more about this panel and what are the goals and aspirations of this group. Elizabeth?
Well, the panel was called together by Fred Bonson, who's the director of the Food, Faith, and Religious Leadership Initiative at Wake Forest University School of Divinity. And he wanted to bring together, we did a similar panel at Wake in Winston-Salem in the fall, and now in Charlotte tonight. He wanted to bring together people from different disciplines in order to discuss the significance of the Pope's encyclical for faith-based attempts to combat climate change.
So that's the key, because we can have conversations about climate change. They've been going on. So the question is, what's the Pope got to do with it?
Mm-hmm. Right. And so this these panels are an avenue for opening up conversations between different disciplines, between scientists. And we had a journalist in the fall, and tonight there will be an entrepreneur from a think tank on clean energy. And myself, in order to bring together these various perspectives and think about a way forward that can motivate people not only from their heads but from their hearts.
Miles, why is it important to bring in all these different disciplines, do you think?
Because it gives a complete picture. You know, with the climate change just isn't a scientific problem, it's a human problem, and I think the Pope makes that really clear in the encyclical. And the other thing that I loved about the event last fall and what I hope happens tonight is when you come together centered on a religious focus, you don't have people going at each other in the same way you do if people come at it from a political focus.
No, but the first critique could be, and it was comical to watch those, especially on the political right in this country who had traded so much on their religious beliefs, suddenly say, you know, religion should be out of politics. It was mildly comical, but it also could be a legitimate critique. What's religion got to do with this? Can it be, Elizabeth, the flip side of that? On the one hand, maybe the conversation will be a little more humane. On the other hand, you know, there's this question about whether or not a religious figure has anything to say about our climate.
Right, right. And that is a common critique, that the church should just stay out of economics, should stay out of these scientific questions. But as Miles just said, this is not just a scientific problem. It's not just an economic problem. It's a human problem. It's a deep problem of the human spirit that needs to be addressed. And addressing spiritual conversion that's necessary in order to combat climate change is something that is within the realm of the job description of someone like Pope Francis.
Tell us more about the encyclical itself and what it called us to do.
So the encyclical, it moves from a description of what is going on in our common home, a description of the ecological crisis, to a theological reflection on that in conversation with scriptures and the Christian theological tradition, spiritual traditions, in order to think about what does this faith tradition, Catholicism and Christianity more broadly, have to say to these problems that we're facing today. And then he moves to suggestions for action, which include suggestions for action in the secular sphere, political, economic actions, not a blueprint for those actions, that's not his job. Then beyond that, he does move to a call for spiritual conversion and ecological spirituality and pedagogy.
And Miles, therein lies some interesting challenges for even those who may be on the more progressive end of the spectrum here, because the Pope is pretty clear about things he does not think will be effective, particularly while he doesn't mention cap and trade in or particularly, he does say that market-based approaches aren't going to work because they promote the very kinds of economic behavior that has so thoughtlessly created the problem. And that's interesting. It's created a little bit of tension between him and some progressives on this.
It has. Maybe I have a rosy glasses view when I read the encyclical, but I don't see him as putting out a proscription to that, but I see him as pointing out the hazards of that, to think that there's going to be, and I think he even talks about the a magical view of the market, that markets are tools that we use to trade things and make our lives better and to think about what we value. And he says we need to inject the moral values into our calculations as well. And I think most people would or should agree with that.
But that we need to redefine our understanding of growth and not assume that every technological development is always for the good, particularly when they're owned and operated by people who only place financial value on those technological. I mean, that's a radical call for conversion, not only in the industries that produce this stuff, but among those of us who consume it.
Yeah, and I think he goes even farther. He says that you can't. Technology is sterile. It's inert unless we put that moral lens on it.
Elizabeth, when you talk about this, I don't know how often you've spoken about the encyclical or engaged in conversations, but it can create some fairly challenging conversations when it comes down to it's okay, especially in progressive circles, to talk about those evil producers of this stuff. But then when you talk about the consumers, and then that's me and my humanitarian flight to some far-flung corner of the globe, it becomes a more challenging question because of the carbon footprint of that flight and whether or not we have to radically ask ourselves if we're the problem because of our consumption habits and our whole patterns of living.
Right. I think it's a really prophetic document in that it denounces that consumerist way of life. And that can be very challenging. But most people that I've talked to about at least that aspect of this encyclical, the need for a radical change of heart vis-a-vis our consumerism, that resonates with a lot of people because it's not only creating problems in the environment with climate change and other ecological crises, it's a deep-seated longing that will never be satisfied by things, right? And so I think it actually resonates with people a good bit.
Miles, what are some of the aspects, some of the particulars within the encyclical that you think can point to a way out? Again, it's a blueprint and not a general prescription, but what do you find in there that's useful for you as a biologist?
Well, the first thing about the encyclical is it's breathtaking in its scope, and the Pope called together, he has an amazing convening power, and he called together all the leaders and all the disciplines. So I think the thing that was most compelling is how well rounded it is. For me, I don't know that it's something that's biological that we're called to do, but you know, he calls us to come into communion with nature, and I think that's profound, to not see it as something that we can ignore, but to really get in and talk about the linkages among organisms in nature and our linkages to them and how we have to cherish them not just for the service that they give to us, but because they're holy.
And again, that's part of this radical conversion that he's pointing to, a relationship with nature that is not an ownership relationship. It's not about how we can exploit this. It's how we live in common with what the Pope would say we should see as a gift and not something that we earned or, for God's sake, bought.
Mm-hmm. Right. And not just a gift for us to use, but a gift to be contemplated and enjoyed in that spiritual sense of appreciating the sacredness, the holiness of it, the presence of God in the world, and nature and other human beings.
Doesn't all of that assume some grounding in this fundamental belief that you somehow have to believe the Pope or any spiritual teaching that would say, this is not yours. You may not own this earth. It came from a transcendent power. Can that be the conversation stopper for many people?
It could be, but I had conversations with non-believers who equally place a sacred value on the earth and recognize that it is not ours. So I think the fundamental difference might not be between whether you believe that God created and gave us the world as a gift or whether you are a non-believer, non-religious. I think the fundamental difference is whether you hold the earth and our environment to be something that is to be respected as and dialogued with and entered into communion with, as opposed to exploited. And
well, and
used.
Whether or not you do, Miles, both the sea level and population are expected to rise by the year 2100, of course, throughout this coming century. But you take a look at how these two issues, I mean, the fact is that we're probably going to outlive some of the worst of the sea level that's already been predicted. Tell us how this dynamic, the actual physical consequences of our not taking this seriously, are going to play out over the next 100 years.
Yeah, so the temperature is going to warm. The temperature by 2100, if we keep going like we're going, is going to be about 4 degrees C warmer. So multiply it by 2 and you get it in Fahrenheit. What that means is that my kids that were born in the climate of Winston-Salem, if they live there their entire life, they'll die in the climate of North Florida. So it's a profound change that we'll have. Now, the great thing about this, well, the good thing about this, is that if we look beyond 2100, a lot of things are going to get better. So population now is projected to go up to 11 billion by 2100. But when we educate women, when we have the basics of health in place, that comes down. When we think about how we want to manage lands, that can get better. And so what we're really doing is we're going through a bottleneck. Temperature will come down as well. So we're going through a bottleneck.
Wait, is this all going to happen naturally? We don't have to do anything? It's all...
The great thing about it, yeah, is that it's in our control. So if we keep going like we're going, we're looking at a pretty bad outcome. If we decarbonize our society.
So in other words, if we do something now, we can still turn things around.
That's right. That bottleneck becomes much less narrow, and we come out on the other side with a world that we'd like to live in. You mentioned sea level rise. That's one that I think we're just going to have to come to grips with, because that doesn't get better at 2100. Sea level continues to get worse. So we're looking at about a meter by 2100. That's probably going to be on the low side. But 2100, by then we're just looking at how the oceans expand. After that, glaciers start to melt, things like that. When it comes to equilibrium, when it'll happen over thousands of years, but we're looking at about 80 feet of sea level rise is the current thought. And we'll alter the environment for 5,000 to 10,000 years.
In the immediate term, Elizabeth, your work also focuses on Latin America, and you've seen communities in Latin America already affected by climate change, and they're benefiting by changing some of their farming practices. Am I right?
Right. So I've done some work with some Christian basic communities in El Salvador, and many of them, especially the rural communities, are working towards sustainable means of providing subsistence agriculture, farming for their families. And so there's a great deal of work around permaculture and sustainable agriculture and organic practices in these communities there. And that is strengthened and heartened by this encyclical as kind of part of the spiritual religious grounding.
And again, it's all tied into local control. If some corporation is controlling the ground on which you work, that changes your relationship to it and also how well you'll fare. But when people have control and they can move to sustainable practices, turns out they're feeding themselves and not doing less damage, which is part of, I think, the Pope's message.
Right, right. And part of his message is also that the overall economic structures that marginalize people who are living in poverty, whether in rural or urban areas, need to change in tandem with all of the ecological changes that we need to focus on.
And Miles, while the Pope does warn that reinforcing the financial structures that of global capitalism probably aren't going to get us out of this, there are certainly business opportunities and ways in which sustainable business can be a part of this. Talk about the connection with business and it's the opportunity for business and in the change.
Yeah, absolutely. Change. When we decarbonize the economy, it's a very different way of mainly generating electricity and transporting ourselves. And Americans, that's what we do best, right, is innovate and think about entrepreneurship. We think about North Carolina, one of the top states in solar, just installed the biggest wind farm in the South. It's a tremendous opportunity for business. And so I think when we just decide, and I think we really did in Paris, the world decided that we were going to bend the curve on the amount of carbon that we use in our lives. And as soon as we do that, you're going to see the business opportunities take off. Matter of fact, the studies show that if we decarbonize the environment, it won't be a big hit to our gross domestic product, but it's actually going to be about a wash, or even might make us a little richer.
I want to thank you both for being on the program. My guest, Miles Silman and Elizabeth Gandolfo. Miles is a conservation biology professor at Wake Forest University. Elizabeth, an assistant professor of Catholic and Latin American Studies at Wake Forest University's Divinity School. They're going to be part of a panel about climate change tonight, 7 o'clock, Wake Forest University Charlotte Center. And you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you both for being on the program. Thank you for listening to The State of Things. The program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton Ormond, and Andrew Tai. Robin Copley's our technical director, with Al Wadarski helping out today. Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stasio. Once again, Kelsey Ledbetter.
First world problems, back and forth and back and forth. What will you do when the real world hits you? What will you say? Are you gonna be okay when mommy and daddy ain't got your back anymore? How will you settle the score? How will you get your foot in the door? When there's no more black cards maxed out and shiny cars is already paid for, how will you deal with not being able to buy your Gucci bag or Louis bag or Chanel rag? But it's so sad that it's so easy when everything good happens to you so naturally. Oh, it's so easy. When everything good is given to you so naturally, we can go back and forth and back and forth about your first world problems, back and forth and back and forth about your first world problems, back and forth and back and forth about your first world problems, back and forth and back and forth. Do you know what hard work is? Do you know what putting your feet in the dirt is? I said, do you know what hard work is? I said, do you know? 'Cause this world ain't no easy, breezy, beautiful cover world. And this world ain't no easy, breezy, beautiful cover world. But you gotta keep your head up, man up and stand up. Keep the peace, keep the peace. Don't turn your back on nobody. You gotta keep your head up, man up and stand up. Keep the peace, keep the peace. Don't turn your back on nobody. I got some first world problems, and I don't think you can solve them, 'cause they ain't real problems. I don't think you can solve them. I got some first world problems, and I don't think you can solve them, 'cause they ain't real problems. I'm just saying, I got some first world blues. I got some first world blues. I don't know what living in the dirt is, what hard work is. I don't know, I don't know. I got some first world problems.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.
I know that Rich Whittington is here from the theater and has a few words to say, and I want to thank you deeply for being here.